This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Das ist Ihre Millionenchance. Jetzt im Lotto-Jackpot. 18 Millionen Euro. 18 Millionen Euro.
Lotto Bayern. Nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Chance auf den Höchstgewinn 1 zu 140 Millionen. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bzga.de.
Hello, I'm Ragini Vaidyanathan. Thanks for downloading the BBC World Tonight podcast from Friday, the 24th of January. Thousands of people are counting the costs after Storm Eowyn unleashed 100-mile-an-hour winds across the UK and Ireland. With 1 million people without power this evening, we'll bring you the latest. Also on the programme, as Donald Trump travels to North Carolina and California on his first trip as president, we'll reflect on what his first whirlwind week back in office tells us about the next 4 years ahead. And the Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg on retracing the final steps of family members who perished in Auschwitz. Thousands of people are hoping for a calmer night after a day of intense storms, rain and wind. Storm Eowyn ripped through parts of Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Northern England. Its force ripped trees from their roots, walls off the side of houses and turned roads into rivers. One man died when a tree fell on his car in County Donegal. More than 1 million homes and businesses are without power across the UK and Ireland as warnings are still in place. This is the sound right now of the storm over the River Foyle in Derry. Well, this is what John Burke, who owns a hotel in West Clare on the Western Irish coast, experienced overnight.
We were in the direct line of it here. I've been born and reared on this site here. I'm 46 years of age and I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it was just pounding the building, pounding the shoreline. And I've been here for different storms along the way. And I love the outdoors. I love the wild nature. I love wind. I love rain. And I love venturing out into it. But my God, last night, when I tried to venture out at any stage, at the height of it, it was just power like I've never experienced before. There's a lot of glazing here facing the ocean. So really large windows. So I was really conscious and nervous that they were going to blow in. And that would add to the building on the inside. So the vibrations and the movement of the windows, the solar panels rattling on the roof, slates flying off the roof, gutters, downpipes, all this just been ripped off the building. So it was like the building was aching and groaning under the pressure of the wind. You could just hear these noise and bangs and just wondering, you know, what it was and was the wind going to get into an attic and lift the roof. So the sounds and the scenes were frightening.
And John, what's the situation now at the hotel?
So it has been calming since about 5 a.m. and it feels relatively under control here. We don't have power still. We're working off a generator, but that needs fuel and we're running out of fuel. So we've been working hard to ensure that we can get the source of fuel and the storage for fuel to keep the business open. We have a very large wedding tomorrow, 280 people. We need to put on an amazing day for them. They don't need to know about generators and fuel and disruptions and ridge tiles missing. They just need an amazing wedding day. So there is a lot of pressure for us to deliver, but you know, that's our job.
Let's hope he does. That's John Burke there. Let's have a listen to Mark Jones, who lives in the Scottish Borders, who was adamant that Storm Eowyn should be described as a hurricane.
Literally, as I opened the side door to the house, I saw the carport physically lifting up from the ground and tipping into the woods. And this isn't a kind of flimsy structure. This is part of an agricultural barn made of heavy tempered corrugating metal. And, you know, the force of the wind to lift it up as I was watching and just tip it into the wood was just quite extraordinary. It was a kind of out-of-body experience, to be honest.
And so when you woke up this morning and surveyed the damage and destruction, what else did you see?
It wasn't so bad at that point, but it got worse as the morning wore on. And we're surrounded by Scottish pines there, and one of those came down onto the driveway, luckily missed everything. I mean, we just seemed to be right in the firing line, and the ridge and the roof also took a hammering and bits of sheet metal were falling off. So it's been a really frightening day, to be honest.
What about insurance? I mean, you've just described extensive damage to your property. Are you going to be able to claim?
It's interesting you ask that, because after this other storm in 2021, when we had a structure in, we got a field adjoining the house and that blew away, and the insurers were great and they paid up. But then when I came to try and get insurance again, it was very difficult. And that's my great fear now.
Mark Jones there. Well, currently there's an amber warning for high winds across parts of Scotland until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. Well, our Scotland correspondent Lorna Gordon is in Glasgow. Good evening to you, Lorna. How is it there at the moment?
Well, calmer, but caution is still being urged because, as you say, this amber warning is still in place till tomorrow morning. But it is a lot quieter. It is a lot more peaceful than the extraordinary situation that unfolded across the central belt and as far south as Dumfries and Galloway during the daylight hours. I mean, this red weather warning for wind kicked in at 10 o'clock. The winds started funneling in from the west. It was disruptive, it was destructive, it was damaging, and it was dangerous. Even in the building which we broadcast from, you could hear it creaking and tiles were being ripped off the roof. At one point, I stood in the lee of the building. It felt fine, it felt protected, but you take just a couple of steps momentarily out into a more exposed area and it became extremely hard to stand. And that's really when I got a sense of just how powerful this storm was. In fact, it's the worst storm to hit the Scottish mainland in 13 years, and it has left a trail of destruction in its wake.
Well, I hope you're okay now and in the warm, Lorna. But of course, there are so many people who don't have power still. Hundreds of thousands of people. Transport services have also been affected. Do we know when things are likely to be in a better condition, weather working order?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the disruption is significant and remains so for the entire day. All the trains were off. The West Coast Calmac ferries were cancelled. People were urged not to take to the roads. Most people heeded that warning, but the Scottish Government said there were still too many lorries out there. A good handful of them toppled over in the winds. The disruption to the rail network has been extensive. We are not expecting to see ScotRail trains to start running again until noon tomorrow at the earliest. And as you say, there's also been disruption to the power network. This evening, at least 100,000 people, we think, according to the latest statistics, remain without power. Engineers, of course, are working around the clock to try and restore electricity to homes. But if you've been left without heating and perhaps without hot water as well, it's a very difficult situation because, you know, the weather is forecast to be extremely cold here in Scotland over the weekend.
Indeed. Lorna Gordon in Glasgow for us. Thank you very much for bringing us the latest on the storm. And we will have more on Storm Eowyn later in the programme with the story of a 400-year-old tree with links to Mary, Queen of Scots, which has collapsed in Glasgow. Now, we're into day five of the 47th presidency of the United States, and President Trump shows no signs of slowing down. Today, he's on his first trip since returning to power. Right now, he's on his way to Los Angeles, to areas affected by the recent fires. And earlier, he was in North Carolina, visiting places ravaged by last year's hurricane.
I promised that I'd come back to Western North Carolina to help the people of the state, and today, here I am, to deliver on that promise. And we have a lot of things in mind, and we're getting the Army Corps of Engineers all set. You need your riverbanks fixed, you need a lot of roads fixed, and we're going to get it done in rapid time.
It's been a long week. It was only on Monday, of course, that Donald Trump stood in the U.S. Capitol pledging a golden age of America. Since then, he signed around 30 executive orders, declared an emergency at the southern border, issued pardons for January 6th rioters, and taken America out of international groupings such as the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement. And that's just some of the headlines. One commentator said that the week so far has been a mix of shock and familiarity among the president's fans and foes alike.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
the office of President of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
I will also declare a national energy emergency. We will drill, baby, drill.
What is this one?
Withdrawing from the World Health Organization, sir.
Ooh, that's a big one.
A set of pardons for peaceful pro-life protesters.
They should not have been prosecuted. This is a great honor to sign this.
The sound of President Trump's pen as he signed those executive orders. Well, so much has, of course, happened in just a few days. It's quite honestly difficult to keep up. Well, to guide us through and reflect on the first few days of Donald Trump's return to power and take a look at what's around the corner, I'm joined by Julian Manchester, a political reporter for The Hill website based in Washington, D.C., and Professor Larry Sabato, director of the Centre for Politics at the University of Virginia. Welcome to both of you. Julia, what stood out for you the most in a week that, as we've said, has headline after headline?
Well, it's certainly been a whirlwind. And once again, Donald Trump is keeping us on our toes. It's a bit like deja vu to 2017 during his first administration. But look, as someone who covered his presidential campaign, the intense focus on immigration has really stood out. He has very much leaned into this issue, you know, hours after taking the oath of office, signing executive orders, declaring a national emergency at the border, sending 1,500 troops to the border, declaring an end to birthright citizenship, which has been challenged by a judge in Seattle, shutting down the Customs and Border Patrol app, which was used by migrants to book appointments with that agency to get into the country legally. The list goes on, but he has really highlighted that issue, an issue that was very important to him on the campaign trail. And it's really a stunning reversal of what we saw from the Biden administration.
And Larry, let me bring you in. Julia there talking about some of those executive orders around immigration. How much, though, do you think President Trump might be stymied by legal challenges and the courts? I mean, we saw yesterday the judgment at the court in Seattle around President Trump's plans to scrap birthright citizenship, for example.
There will be lots of court challenges, and some of them, maybe many of them, will succeed. Let's remember that Joe Biden, for all of the elements we could cite where he came up short, actually exceeded the number of federal judges that he was able to appoint and confirm during his four-year term compared to Trump's first four-year term. So I think that's a major problem for Trump, and Trump is a major problem for Trump. He simply can't go through a week with only positive stories. He has to create disasters like the pardoning of hundreds and hundreds of insurrectionists, some of whom beat up over 140 law enforcement officers. He pardoned every single one of them, including the really dangerous extremists. That has stuck with people more than any single thing he's done this week.
And Julia, just moving on to comings and goings at the West Wing. We've been hearing more about the relationship between Donald Trump and Elon Musk with reports that Susie Wiles, of course, who's Mr. Trump's chief of staff, has denied Elon Musk a proper office in the West Wing.
Yeah, look, I mean, Elon Musk is someone who we've heard from, you know, people close to the president that, you know, there's been a growing frustration with Elon Musk and the amount of time he spent around Mar-a-Lago, for example, during the transition. He was at Trump's Thanksgiving dinner table. He's been on calls with Trump with foreign leaders. Trump has gone to watch SpaceX launches. Elon Musk is in his family photos. I mean, Elon Musk has very much detached himself to Donald Trump. And this week there was, a video that emerged of Elon Musk shortly after the inauguration in which he appeared to be given, whether it's unintentional or intentional, he says it's unintentional, but what looks like sort of a Nazi salute in some way. And that's caught a lot of negative attention. And I think there is a concern that Elon Musk, with how freewheeling he's been with his commentary, for example, on X, that that could, you know, somehow in a way overshadow President Trump and, you know, President Trump wanting to implement his agenda. Susie Wiles is someone who, to the best of her abilities, and only Trump can control Trump, and only Trump decides who he wants to talk to, who he doesn't want to talk to. But during the campaign, she did a very good job, or best as she could, at controlling his messaging and controlling who got to Trump. And she's trying to do that as chief of staff. So there has been some growing frustrations in, you know, Trumpian circles about Elon Musk. I'm not surprised that we're starting to see more of this reporting, more of these headlines. But ultimately, Donald Trump will be the one to decide, you know, who's in and who's out.
And Larry, I covered Mr. Trump's first term, and it didn't take too long for there to be divisions in the West Wing. And of course, as we saw after those first 4 years of his time in office, many people who were once close to him coming out quite critical. How much discipline do you think there is in this particular top team at the White House compared with the first time? Because as we heard just then from Julia, that is core when it comes to actually keeping things on track.
Somehow, I think they have done a better job this time in one respect, which is to put together a team that can be more unified. And that's because this team has very, very few truly independent people who will challenge President Trump. The major criterion they used in the selection of key staffers and cabinet members was fealty, not just loyalty, fealty. I think they've been having genuflection classes, so they're all very good at getting on their knees as needed to please Donald Trump. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of what you saw in the first term. That was a lesson Donald Trump learned in the first term. He also learned what it is to be president. He really was unprepared to take over the presidency, and it showed, and he wasted a lot of time. One thing you can say about him this week, even if you dislike every single thing he's done, he hasn't wasted a minute.
Yeah, I mean, he said at Davos that he's accomplished more in less than 4 days than other administrations have accomplished in 4 years. Julia, just briefly, because we don't have too much time, I just wanted to get your thoughts on where you see this second iteration of a President Trump when it comes to foreign affairs and the way he projects himself as a world leader from what we've seen so far.
Look, to Larry's point, he is much more prepared this time. I think he understands, dealing with a number of, how to deal with foreign leaders, sort of how this goes. But we've seen him telegraphing this week that he's really pushing the America First agenda in terms of, threatening tariffs, for example, on the European Union. He has been somewhat critical of Vladimir Putin in the war in Ukraine and saying that China should play a bigger role in ending that conflict. But overall, I think he's much more prepared this time. That being said, though, he's very much sticking with that America First foreign policy ideology.
Julia Manchester, Larry Sabato, we could talk for an hour on this subject, but we've run out of time. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, the UK has the largest stockpile of radioactive plutonium, which is a product of nuclear fuel processing. And it's been piling up for decades, stored under armed guard at the Sellafield nuclear plant at great expense, more than £70 million a year. Successive governments have hung on to it in case it could be recycled into new nuclear fuel. But today, the Energy Minister, Michael Shanks, announced that they're going to dispose of it. So, how and why? Victoria Gill is our science correspondent.
We have the world's largest stockpile of plutonium. It's not all ours. Some of it is from fuel that's been reprocessed from other countries. And it's because we have been stockpiling it, essentially. So it's been for decades, since the 1950s, it's been piling up at Sellafield because it's a product of the reprocessing of used nuclear fuel. And successive governments have essentially kept it because it might be something that would be reused, recycled and turned into nuclear fuel, which is entirely possible. But now no energy company has expressed any interest in reusing it as nuclear fuel. And this government has decided and made an announcement today that it should be disposed of. And that will mean immobilizing it. That will mean turning it into something stable that can be safely disposed of.
Is it safe?
This is the problem. At the moment, the risk is building up with the stockpile of plutonium, and it's being stored securely at Sellafield, but it's extremely technically difficult, and it is a very high-risk, hazardous product. It's highly radioactive. It has to be repackaged and recontained relatively frequently because the containers that it's stored in its form that keeps it sort of useful and reprocessable, means that those containers have to be changed and cleaned because the radiation contaminates them, and it has to be stored under armed guard. So that costs the UK taxpayer more than £70 million per year. So it's high risk, it's a security concern, and it's also dangerous and a difficult technical challenge for Sellafield. So the plan is to what they call immobilise it. And that basically means that it will be turned into a more stable, solid product, and its ultimate destination will be deep underground. It will be disposed of permanently.
And I guess the next question then is, how do they immobilise it? What is that process, Victoria?
So that is a process that is already done relatively routinely at Sellafield. And that essentially means baking it into a solid structure. So you take nuclear waste, you melt it down, and then you bake it at very high temperatures into something like a ceramic or a glass. And that's a very, very stable, solid product. You know, it's very much like the rocks in which we find uranium. The idea is to try and bake it back into those rocks. So that's going to be the process. They still don't know exactly what that material will be. It will be some kind of ceramic, and that is something that is being researched right now. And it's only by the end of this decade that that will be carried out at Sellafield. And then it will be taken to a deep geological facility. And here's the other caveat. We don't have a deep geological facility yet. The government's in the early stages of planning of choosing a site for that deep geological storage facility. And the earliest that that would be ready, they haven't chosen a location for it yet, will be in the 2050s. So this is a long process, but nothing happens quickly with nuclear materials, and neither should it, because everything needs to be done extremely carefully.
And you can read more on that story from Victoria on the BBC News website. British nationals have been told to leave the city of Goma in the Central African country of the Democratic Republic of Congo as fighting intensifies there. Observers have warned that the conflict could spark a regional war. More than 400,000 people have been displaced this year alone. Congolese forces are clashing with fighters from the M23 group, which experts from the UN say is backed by neighbouring Rwanda. Well, Akil Imani Saleh Choma Choma is an independent journalist based in Goma, a city of more than a million people.
People are really afraid about the possibility for the M23 to take Goma. People are trying to go out of Goma. And on the market, there is so many people who are trying to get money, to withdraw money from ATM of banks, and because banks didn't work. Prices are increasing right now.
So who are the M23 rebel group and what's behind the fighting? Well, I've been speaking to Jason Stearns, author of the book The War That Doesn't Say Its Name, The Unending Conflict in the Congo.
There's been conflict in the DRC, the Congo, now for almost 30 years. And much of this conflict gets back to the same issue, which is the rivalry between the Congo and its much, much smaller neighbor, Rwanda. And over the years, there have been numerous rebellions backed by the Rwandan government that have fought against the Congolese government. So the M23 is the latest one of these rebellions. It emerged in November of 2021, and it has gradually increased the size of its territory. It controls a large area of very fertile, very mineral-rich land around this trade hub of Goma that they now threaten to take.
You mentioned the very fertile land and mineral-rich, of course. What is driving this conflict? Is it that?
Well, it's difficult to reduce this just to one issue, but I think it boils down to the fact that Rwanda sees this part of the Congo as within its sphere of interest for a variety of reasons. There are rebels there that want to overthrow the Rwandan government. Rwanda continually cites them as a security threat. And yes, there are minerals. Rwanda exports every year around $800 million of minerals, mostly gold. And much of that comes from the eastern DRC. And so it benefits from there being chaos in the eastern DRC, and it has, since 1996, tried to project its influence into the eastern DRC. On the flip side, the Congolese government is not blameless in all of this. It is a much, much larger country, has a much larger army, and yet it has struggled to impose itself and to govern this territory. In fact, it often benefits itself from conflict in the east.
And is the Rwandan government supporting this rebel group in any way?
Oh, absolutely. There is extensive documentation, including by United Nations investigators, that show that Rwanda has sent thousands of special forces. It's sent surface-to-air missiles. It's sent armored vehicles. This has been denounced by many Western governments. So I think there's very little doubt that Rwanda is backing the M23.
And of course, there are fears from the UN and other groups about a looming humanitarian crisis with hundreds of thousands of people internally displaced having to flee their homes since the start of this year.
Yeah, so just to paint a picture, Goma is a beautiful town on Lake Kivu. Just north of Goma is a massive volcano near a Gongo volcano. And surrounding Goma are thousands and thousands of makeshift shelters where displaced people have run to from the fighting. So you have hundreds of thousands of people displaced, huddled around Goma. And if the M23 fighting comes towards Goma, these people will have nowhere to run to. There are hundreds of international organizations that have their base in Goma. The United Nations and its peacekeeping mission have a huge base in Goma. It's the only international airport in the region. And so if Goma falls, many of those people will leave. And the food, the shelter, the healthcare that those organizations provide to those displaced people will disappear.
So if Goma falls, that's really pivotal. How likely is that as we see more advances?
I really don't know. A couple of days ago, I said it was unlikely. I think that in the past, every time a Rwandan-backed rebellion has taken Goma, this story goes from being very peripheral to being in the headlines. And that doesn't serve Rwanda very much. In the past, that's led to a backlash and lots of pressure on Rwanda, and then eventually has spelled the end of those previous rebellions. And so that's why I would have thought that Rwanda would have been reluctant to push it this far. But as you can see now, I think especially with the transition happening in the United States to the Trump administration, the U.S. has been the most critical of the Rwandan government during this escalation. I think they may be taking a chance and pushing their luck.
And what is the international community doing to try and de-escalate this?
Unfortunately, not very much, not enough. And that's actually strange because Rwanda is very dependent on aid. Around 40% of its budget comes from international aid. Its reputation is extremely important to it. You'll see Visit Rwanda emblazoned on Arsenal jerseys, on PSG jerseys, for example. And yet the international community has done very, very little. Under the previous conservative government in the UK, they didn't want to rock the boat too much in Rwanda because of this asylum deal that they brokered with the Rwandan government. But even under the current Labour administration, they certainly haven't imposed sanctions, as has been done in the past on Rwanda for similar things. And other countries, similarly, France relies on Rwandan troops to protect oil and gas installations in Mozambique. The U.S. government is happy with the fact that Rwanda has sent troops to the Central African Republic, where it's a counterweight to the Russian troops that are also deployed there. So Rwanda has been able to make itself very useful to the international community. And that gives it, I think, some critical political leverage in moments like these.
Jason Stearns there. Now, Monday marks 80 years since the liberation of the Nazi death camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau. More than a million people were systematically murdered there as part of the Nazi campaign to try and eradicate the Jewish population of Europe. No one who survived Auschwitz will ever forget what happened there, but their numbers are dwindling with the passing years. Many are trying to preserve the cultural memory of the Holocaust for future generations, with concerns the horrors may be forgotten or even denied. Here on Radio 4, we've been hearing from survivors and their families as they look back on a dark chapter in history. Like the BBC journalist Daniel Wittenberg and his uncle, Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg, who recently revisited Auschwitz for a documentary which airs on Sunday. Well, they've been speaking to The World Tonight's Sean Lay. First, Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg.
From both sides of my family were refugees from Nazi Germany. My father lost his grandmother and two of his aunts together with their families. My mother's side, her aunt simply disappeared. We've never been able to trace what happened to her.
Daniel Wittenberg, how much was this talked about in the family as you were growing up?
I think growing up as a young Jewish boy, you're aware that the Holocaust happened, that 6 million Jews died, and indeed some of your ancestors didn't make it. What I heard most growing up was the stories of survival of my Uncle Jonathan's parents, my grandparents. What they felt less comfortable talking about was the traumatic experience before that point of living under Nazi rule and talking about the family members that were lost.
And there will be people, obviously, Rabbi Jonathan, at the commemorations at Auschwitz, who are still able to tell that story firsthand.
And there'll be people there who lost absolutely everybody. And Danny's correct that the focus on our family was mainly being refugees, and the immediate family got out, and the story of getting out was a lot of what was talked about round the table. It was only later, really, after my father's death, that I discovered a huge trove of family letters from the years 1937 all the way to 1948, and was able to put some sense of image and story to names I'd only heard from my father.
You both have visited, I understand, in the past, but you visited together for the BBC Sunday Worship programme. What was that experience like?
So this time, going as a family felt very powerful, and it was just such a reminder of how lucky our family are and how glad I am that we're all here in North London together.
Rabbi Jonathan, for you, I mean, there will be many people listening to this around the world who have never been there, and they may not even know a great deal about these camps. Perhaps you can explain what it has meant to you in those visits, and in particular, perhaps give a little description of what people would see.
There's Auschwitz and then there's Birkenau. Auschwitz I today is very much of a museum. Huge red brick buildings. You go through and you see the suitcases, the shoes, the hair shaved off people as they were taken into this underworld. But you also, if you've got time, you see on the walls the documents, Topf and Son, how they supplied the gas ovens, their contracts, as if they didn't actually grasp what it was that their products were going to be used for. You go to Birkenau, it's very different. It's about 3 kilometers away, and it is bare and vast. There are still the fences, the rusting barbed wire. These were electric fences. And you come to the ruins of the crematoria. Big grey concrete slabs now sort of smashed in, but very present. And what I've said to people when I've led groups to do is just listen, because it's as if there's a subliminal presence of the voices of the dead, their last thoughts, their last greetings, their partings from loved ones. And to go there with my nephew Danny, with my son Amos, was a kind of transmission that can't be communicated in words.
And that idea of it being carried across generations does give some hope for the future, doesn't it, Daniel, that it could be not something that's just in the history books?
Yeah, it did fill me with hope, and it just made me think that there are opportunities to learn from mistakes that happen, even if not as immediately as you sometimes need, mainly just through people telling stories.
Storytelling is incredibly important to all of our sense of identity, isn't it, Rabbi Jonathan? And I just wonder what the dilemma is for people who lived through the Holocaust and survived the Holocaust.
It's an important question to which there are many sides, but my former teacher and colleague, Rabbi Rodney Mariner, apparently used to speak not of the liberation of Auschwitz, but of the revelation of Auschwitz. That when that came to light in the world, what was to be learnt? What was to be seen? And I'm a bit cautious about using the word 80 years since the liberation, as if suddenly people were free, because people carried the burden of what they'd been through. People are different. Many people whose stories I heard much later in their lives, they wanted to create a family, they wanted to create a new life because they'd lost everybody. And one admires that guts. For others, life was lonely and haunted and extremely difficult. And that mustn't be forgotten. And there were those who were ready to tell their story, but felt that people didn't want to listen. And there were those who could never tell their story because it hurt too much. And the way to face the future was not to tell. But I would say that there's an importance of witness, that it matters deeply that people are listened to.
Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg and his nephew Daniel Wittenberg. And you can hear their documentary on Sunday Worship here on Radio 4 on Sunday morning at 8:10. And on Monday's World Tonight, the BBC's Tim Franks will be in Auschwitz on the day of the 80th anniversary. He'll be speaking to survivors of the camp as well as historians to ask them about how we remember the Holocaust. Well, before we end the programme, let's return to our main story. And as we've been reporting, the power of Storm Eowyn has left a trail of devastation across large parts of the UK. And it's left a tree, which has links to Mary, Queen of Scots, badly damaged. For centuries, the Darnley sycamore has stood tall in Glasgow, but the winds have rendered the tree unrecognisable. Photos of the aftermath of the storm show piles of huge branches ripped away from the famous tree. Well, historian Kate Williams is a biographer of Mary, Queen of Scots, and she joins me now. Welcome to The World Tonight, Kate. I was looking at the pictures of the tree. I mean, it's devastating to see, actually. I mean, I know there's lots of other things that have happened today in relation to the storm. How significant is this tree?
It's heartbreaking. It's a beautiful tree. It's such a famous tree in Glasgow. It's so important to the Scottish people. And, you know, for it to be the tree that perhaps Lord Darnley, second husband of Mary, Queen of Scots, father of the future James VI of Scotland, James I of England, Scotland and Wales, that was where Mary, Queen of Scots and Lord Darnley sat together when she was nursing him back to health. That's the story. But if that's even possible, if that was a tree that Mary, Queen of Scots saw, it's so sad to lose it. We've lost nearly everything of Mary, Queen of Scots, the great Scottish queen, her dresses, her books, her all of her life. And perhaps this tree was something to her, and that's now gone. The very fact that this tree has been standing since Stuart Scotland, and it's now been devastated, is really so sad.
Incredible. Hundreds of years that tree's been standing there. And of course, Kate, I mean, trees are really important reminders of our ancient past, aren't they?
Trees are, you know, they go back so many years. Trees are some of the oldest things that we will ever see. And every part of history stuns me. But the fact that you can go out there as a historian and think, I'm looking at a tree that Henry VIII could have seen, and I'm looking at a tree that Mary, Queen of Scots could have seen and perhaps would have enjoyed and got the same pleasure. We use the phrase forest bathing, don't we, modern days? But that's what they did in the 16th, 15th medieval times as well. They found the restorative power of the forest. And so it is really sad to lose it. And it was such a crucial part of history. Darnley's castle, Crookston Castle in Glasgow, that was where they had their family seat. So he and Mary went back and forth to there. He was there when he was ill. She was looking after him. And this point where Darnley was ill and Mary was visiting him, and then he came to Edinburgh, not long after that, his house was blown up. He was found smothered. And that was the end of that. So that's the end of Mary, Queen of Scots' story.
OK, Kate Williams, thank you very much for taking us through that story. She said it's the end of that story, and it's also the end of the programme. That's it for The World Tonight. I'm Regina Vaidyanathan. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night. Have a good weekend.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
you just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.